Welcome to the First Things podcast. On this episode, news comes that poetry has gone viral on social media since the election of Donald Trump, serving as therapy or as tweetable polemic. I'll talk to Mark Bauerlein about a public role for poetry in a time of political tension and attention deficits. Then, four cardinals have delivered five dubia to Pope Francis, registering concerns about the apostolic exhortation Amoris Laetitia. Elliot Milko will teach you a new Latin word and explain why schism remains highly unlikely. Finally, a special Thanksgiving message on behalf of all of us at First Things. I'm Associate Editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. Last week, The Atlantic published an interview titled, Still, Poetry Will Rise. The interviewer is Megan Garber, and she talks with Don Scher, the editor of Poetry Magazine. The occasion for the interview is the news that poetry has gone viral in the aftermath of Donald Trump's election, as political liberals seek to console themselves or recover their fighting spirit. The title of the interview is, of course, allusive to Maya Angelou's therapeutic poem, Still I Rise. Several outlets have gone beyond the obvious, however, and have compiled little helpful anthologies for the Trump era. The Guardian asks, what kind of poetry can get us through a Donald Trump presidency? And then answers with a few selections, heavy on Langston Hughes. The Huffington Post offers 18 compassionate poems to help you weather uncertain times. Vox, surprisingly, does best, with a totally apocalyptic lead, but actually some good and apposite poems. Now, we are tempted to ridicule this therapeutic moment of viral poetry, and we will not, in fact, resist that temptation. But The Atlantic interview with Don Scher is kind of worthwhile. The discussants raise some very real points about the role of poetry in public, not just political, life. I'm joined now by senior editor Mark Bauerlein. We'll begin with a little bit of ridicule, and then we'll move on to higher things. So, Mark, you and I both read one particular poem that went viral on Twitter after the election of Trump. It is Differences of Opinion by the British poet Wendy Cope, published in 2006 in Poetry Magazine. It's been described as a sharp evisceration of mansplaining. It's a poem actually in two parts, but people conveniently seem not to have noticed the second part. Anyway, I'll read the first part, which has all the attention, and Mark, you can comment. So, differences of opinion. He tells her that the earth is flat. He knows the facts, and that is that. In altercations fierce and long, she tries her best to prove him wrong. But he has learned to argue well. He calls her arguments unsound, and often asks her not to yell. She cannot win. He stands his ground. The planet goes on being round. Mark, would you like to mansplain this poem? Are you feeling sharply eviscerated?
You know, the thing about the poem is there's no imagination. There is no wit to the poem. There's no moral or psychological complication to it. We've got an obtuse guy and a reasonable gal who is trying to overcome his stupidity, but he simply is, he's a rock. And he's arguing the earth, you know, the world is flat. Couldn't we have gotten something a little more interesting than that? Something that wouldn't immediately have us say at the end of that first line, he's an idiot. And say at the end of the last line, he's still an idiot and there is nothing more to say about him. So the evisceration, I just don't see, especially as you know what happens on the second page.
Right. So if you turn the page in this issue of Poetry Magazine, the second part of the poem, it has a second part, and the second part is subtitled, Your Mother Knows, and the woman is disputing the shape of the earth with her mother. So this is, I suppose, a sharp evisceration of mom-splaining. The relevance of that part of the poem to the election of Trump is very unclear to me. Anyhow, people want to say that this poem sort of encapsulates something about our current political moment, which has been defined in large part by a tense relationship both with women and with facts. So that was sort of the official gloss on it in The Atlantic. But as you say, Mark, the poem itself is not very good on its own terms, and it doesn't actually do the work that people on Twitter want it to do, which may demonstrate for us the perils of disseminating verse via tweet.
I think that what it expresses is the alignment of that benighted male figure with Donald Trump. And someone who, I mean, that's the equation there. And it simply voices the frustration of so many people who just cannot understand how such a blustering boob could have become the leader of our country. I think there's a little bit of an anti-science element to it, with the world is flat and, you know, people going after Trump for denying climate change, and of course the sexist aspects to it as well. So that the poem serves as an opportunity for people to vent something that they already feel. Now, we often ask good poetry to do more than this, right? I mean, this is one of the things that poetry can do for people, but it's not going to make you go back to the poem when you might feel a little bit differently. It's not going to make you stop for a second and see, wait a minute, there are some other elements to a situation like this that we don't quite realize. The second poem starts to turn things a little more in a complicated direction, because we've got a different situation now. We've got the mom speaking, which makes us reflect back upon the speaker a little bit. Now, that there's a complication worth examining. But if we're just going to look at the first page, we don't get that. So I actually think that poetry should have more of a popular role of this kind, that we do give poetry the chance to be a direct expression of patriotism, a direct expression of political or partisan passions of some kind. You do it in verse. That can be very, very neat and handy and memorable. It can become a slogan for people. You know, this is what song can do. So I actually approve of the delivery of poetry into the public sphere. We need more crafted verse. This one even rhymes. And actually, the prosody of the poem is pretty good. It works. There could be an element here of the turn to poetry by many people because the idiom of the public sphere has become so simplistic and degraded. Someone who can fashion words, craft them into structure and form. Now, what a nice reprieve from what we get on Twitter and over the web and just in political discourse in general in our country.
The trouble is, the hope here is that Twitter is going to be the vehicle for the rise of poetry. And I think that in this instance with the Wendy Cope poem, which basically got split in half and only the first half of it read and the complexifying second half ignored, you know, I think the reason that happened was because everybody was reading what they read of the poem through a screenshot on Twitter. You know, and so you see the perils of counting on social media as a medium for bringing poetry back into a kind of public prominence. You know, I think some people want to imagine that there's a sort of formal suitability to that because, you know, line breaks and 140 character limits, you know, that might work or something. But I just think sort of the social logic of social media is such that it's going to reduce the complexity of poetry rather than complexify the discourse on social media.
Right. The medium isn't benign here.
Right.
And it's going to shape and form what can be said. It sets limits. Sometimes limits are good, but here in this case, where we're going to lose too many things. Now, you know, what I would like is for people to take works of verse and you reread them, right? You read them in social media, and it's such an accelerated environment. You read them, you pass it along, you spread it out, and everything is fast, fast, fast. Good poetry requires some slow reading, as they call it. I work with students, and it is very difficult for them to take lines of verse, I make them do this, by Emily Dickinson. Pause over one line. Further in summer than the birds. There's a line. Stop. Okay, let's look at the music of that line. Further, summer, birds. Okay, we got some music there with the sound pattern. What does it mean? What is further in summer than the birds? What does that mean? We work that out as well. But you can see that initially, I'm teaching a full course in American poetry next semester. You can see that it is not customary for them to slow down, to pause over a specific metaphor, right? To look at the position of a word in a line and look at the language, look at subtexts and sounds, rhythm. They suddenly want to move fast through the words, and that is customary for young people who average 3,500 text messages a month, who race through the internet. You know, if you stand behind them in the library and watch them surfing the web, they spend a few seconds on a site and bump, they're jumping elsewhere. If you look at web pages, they become more and more schematic, bullet points and font changes, more visualized in certain ways, and that's something that web page designers are very conscious of. The poetic experience runs against so many of the dispositions that go with social media. So you're going to get not only forms of verse that are very pared down, like this one, but verse that is amenable to simple messages, right? Something that you can say, check this poem out. What a great example of mansplaining. There, you got it. Okay, pass it along. And it is the characterization of the poem often that prompts the distribution of it than the object itself.
Let's talk more broadly about the relation of poetry and politics. So The Guardian says, what kind of poetry can get us through a Donald Trump presidency? We'll need satire and spitting vitriol. We'll need rallying cries. We'll need reminders of human dignity. And to me, these are actually not necessarily wrong uses of poetry. I mean, in historical perspective, these are some things that poetry has done and has done well.
If you talk about reminders of human dignity, those are good things. Poetry that makes us give a bigger comprehension of human society than what electoral politics, give us. These are all good things. It is not going to be a good thing if you tie it so much to the motivation of anti-Trump. Okay, we got to get through the Trump years. This is inevitably going to give us a constrained expression. It's going to make the poetry sound tendentious from the start, and also it's going to limit your audience highly. I mean, there are some people who don't regard the prospect of a Trump presidency as Armageddon. They feel, oh yeah, you know, it's going to be bad. But that's not everything in life. A lot of things go on, and they will go on. I've got other needs. I got to go to work. I've got kids, schools. I've got a car that needs to be fixed. I've got to go to the dentist. These are much the basic things of life that have nothing much to do with politics in any direct way, and those can be occasions for the drive to poetry, as much as anything. Getting caught in traffic. Might be nice to plug some poetry, books on tape, and listen to to Homer talking about a heroic age that you're not sitting in the freeway.
Yeah, it strikes me that the suspicion of poetry as being politically tendentious seems like a fairly new thing. You know, in centuries past, poets who were interested in politics might produce not just, you know, critiques, satire and polemic, but also earnest crystallizations of political theory or theology, you know, your Miltons, your Marvells, your Popes. And anciently, say, praise of a royal house was a very valid reason for verse. And I'm kind of wondering why this is no longer true. Why is it that now we tend to distrust poetry that is overtly politically engaged? We tend to think that that's propaganda, that's not real, that's not real art.
The Aeneid had a close relationship to the Roman Empire, and it's still great. That doesn't take away from its sublimity and wisdom at all. And you can take moral lessons. I mean, a great poem is always more than a political partisanship, but it can certainly be politically partisan, and often has been. And, you know, poets had their patrons, poets had the church, they had their sponsors, and they did what their sponsors often wanted them to do. I think the disengagement of poetry from sort of public affairs really is a function of the rise of a middle class reading public in the 18th century, which gave us the writer who Fustrovol is working more in a bourgeois world, which can talk about things that have nothing to do with kings and queens, nothing to do with institutions, but can be much more individualized, much more personalized. Alexander Pope's Essay on Man is not going to have that very personal, individual frame, like this is about me, my life, sort of the expressive function, than you would find in Coleridge's conversation poems. For instance, the development of the poet, and this really goes back to Romanticism, ultimately the poet has a figure of individual expression. You know, Wordsworth's formula for this was poetry is the spontaneous overflow of powerful feeling, and it takes its root in emotion recollected in tranquility. This is a definition that wouldn't have made very much sense to John Donne. Or even to Samuel Johnson, who wasn't that much earlier, 50 years earlier, before Wordsworth. So I think when you got that personalization of poetry, more and more the poetic voice was someone who was sort of free and independent of any institutions, and this became a claim. It became especially a claim when we had the rise of the bohemian figure in the mid-19th century, with French poets in particular, with the Baudelaire and those who followed with him. And then that, you know, evolved into modern aestheticism and modernism and the full flowering of the counterculture in mid-19th century, or mid-20th century America, in which the poet is somewhat of an adversarial figure. The poet is defined against bourgeois values, defined against political power. If you read Allen Ginsberg's Howl, the government is the enemy. Power, really of any form, is the enemy in the beatniks, the beat generation, and the counterculture in general. And this became, I mean, Walt Whitman was sort of a grandfather in America for them, but this really became the noblest moral conception of the poet, and the counterculture poets were extremely moralistic. You know, they were anarchical in terms of social norms, but they were terrific scolds. Okay, they hated inauthenticity. They hated people who were co-opted. All that language comes out in the 1950s counterculture. And so that was poetry becomes its sort of own more authentic, pure universe, where it is the human soul, the human heart, the human emotion speaking in its own voice for itself. And so when they talk today about poetry getting us through the Trump years, they don't see that poetry as a line with a different politics. This is really, it's a coping mechanism, and it is very personalized, individualized. There's no larger political meaning to that, the poem that you read, the mansplaining poem. That's really about women who have been condescended to and shut down by men. That's it. And you consult your own experience for that. And we can talk about the slogan, the personal is political. But it's really the personal is personal. And we'll give it a political sheen. But it really comes into experiential reality there. And I think it's one reason why poetry has so little impact on public life in America. I mean, the founding fathers and actually political leaders through the 18th century, they would have been surprised to find the Republic of Letters so disconnected from politics. I mean, they all believed that every leader should be familiar with Virgil. That's why they put a line from Virgil on our dollar bill. George Washington had staged a performance in Valley Forge at the worst times of Addison's Cato, his play, which was his favorite literary work, because we go to literature, you know, as part of our public being. This helps shape our civic values and our political culture. You know, John Quincy Adams, you know, before he was president, he was a professor of belles lettres in Harvard. So it's only in 19th century and after that the poetic figure was not right up there with other kinds of civic leaders.
Yeah, the retreat of poetry from institutional politics leaves a man in an awkward position when he gets elected president and needs someone to read poetry at his inauguration, right? So Obama had inaugural poets at both of his go-rounds. I don't remember the second one, but I remember in 2009 when Elizabeth Alexander read Praise Song for the Day. What I remember about it was that it was totally forgettable, except in so far as it was memorably bad. For those presidents who sort of want to appropriate, or politicians who want to appropriate cultural prestige insofar as that resides in poets today, it's very awkward. I mean, where do you go for someone who can write and read aloud a poem that will strike Americans as speaking in some meaningful way to what we do when we elect a president? I mean, it's a very thin bench.
Let's have a poet get up there and not read his or her own poem.
Ah.
How about reading Walt Whitman, I Hear America Singing? It's not Whitman's greatest poem, but read something out of Song of Myself, or Song of the Open Road. Have someone go out there and read some ancient heroic poetry as well. Something that can't be so aligned with the current moment, but which can become broadly inspiring. I think that would be a great statement that President Trump could make at that moment. How about something? How about some Shakespeare? How about some Julius Caesar? Something out of Julius Caesar about power and principle. I think that in itself would be a statement that, one, at times like these, we go to the past. We try to call up out of the best materials of the collected wisdom of the ages things that are going to, one, elevate the public discourse, two that are going to show, you know, what's happening right now is just one thing in a long, long line in the march of civilization. And then things are going to go up and down again. And we look for solidity, right, in the best that has been thought and said. And it would make it harder for the professors to knock Trump as an oaf.
Well, who's your dream poet at Trump's inauguration?
Who would speak?
Mm-hmm.
I think what we should do is have our last annual poet, Dana Gioia, who's a great reader, read heroic public poetry in the past. That's what we should do. If a literary culture decays, a political culture is going to decay not that long after. And why is that? Why is that? One, it is because, you know, the state of our language is an index of the state of everything else. And poetry and the teaching and learning of it is one way in which we keep the language fresh. You know, as Pound put it, make it new. And the second thing is the interpretation of it builds in a flexibility of thought and a recognition of things being more complicated than they seem. First impressions are often misleading or incorrect. You've got to dig a little deeper to understand a little bit more about this voice. If you memorize that poem, you've got to get into another character besides yourself. If you're going to pronounce those words right, you've got to feel and experience what those words mean, which again gets you out of your own narrow consciousness. And that this is all good for the civic sphere, right? This is important for civic health. George Orwell thought this, Leavis, I mean, the New York intellectuals all believe this, and I think they're absolutely right.
I'd like to conclude with my offering to these emerging anthologies of poetry for the Trump era. I propose Thomas Hardy's Convergence of the Twain, which was written on the occasion of the sinking of the Titanic. It's a little long for our purposes, so I'll do just highlights. Picking up in the middle, Hardy has some sea creatures swimming around the wreck of the Titanic. Dim, moon-eyed fishes near gaze at the gilded gear and query, what does this vaingloriousness down here? Well, while was fashioning this creature of cleaving wing, the imminent will that stirs and urges everything prepared a sinister mate for her so gaily great, a shape of ice, for the time far and dissociate. Then Hardy goes on to show that the Titanic is being built and the iceberg is ominously growing. Alien they seemed to be. No mortal eye could see the intimate welding of their later history, or sign that they were bent by paths coincident on being anon twin halves of one august event, till the spinner of the years said, now, and each one hears, and consummation comes, and jars two hemispheres.
Very good.
So that's Thomas Hardy's Convergence of the Twain. And there are several ways in which this poem could be appropriated for our cultural moment. If you're a liberal, you could read it just therapeutically as an expression of shock over a momentous, unforeseen, but apparently fated disaster. You could also read it predictively as a figuration of the HMS Trump and what comes of vaingloriousness. Or if you're a Trump supporter or just simply mischievous, you could read it as a poem about the futility of prediction. The polls failed. You know who else was unsinkable until she hit an iceberg? Hillary Clinton, though it wasn't exactly her maiden voyage.
There we go. All sides. Read into it.
And it's slow reading.
There we go. There we go.
It's been months since Pope Francis's apostolic exhortation Amoris Laetitia was released. You may be sick of talking about it, but we're not. In fact, we're feeling pretty dubious about it right now. We're joined in this feeling by four cardinals. Three are retired, the other is Raymond Leo Burke. These cardinals recently presented the Pope with five dubia, doubts or questions concerning Amoris Laetitia. Here to explain all about it is Deputy Editor Elliot Milko. So Elliot, about these five dubia, what are they inquiring about? What is the purpose of presenting them to the Holy Father?
So just a little bit of a refresher on Amoris Laetitia. So Amoris Laetitia is a post-synodal apostolic exhortation by Pope Francis that followed up the work of the two past meetings of the Synod of Bishops that dealt with issues of marriage and the family in the Church. Francis's large sort of summary document that he produced touches on all sorts of different aspects of evangelism, the moral life of the family, the gospel in the family, all of these things. And interestingly, in the eighth chapter of the document, it deals with questions of irregular situations, so difficult cases, most notably cases of Catholics who have been divorced and entered civilly into second marriages, which are not recognized by the Church because, as many listeners probably know, settled Catholic teaching on marriage is that if you have a sacramental marriage that is recognized as valid by the Church, that's it. You can't have another one unless your spouse dies. So Francis, in this document, seems to introduce the possibility that people who are living in what the Church would recognize as a state of adultery with someone who is not their spouse can receive the sacraments without resolving to remove themselves from that sinful state of life. And this is, it's a difficult issue because this deals with things that are very personal to people. I mean, if you've gone through a marriage and it's broken up and you're trying again, I mean, obviously this is stuff that is really hard for people. So Francis has compassion for that, and I think the impulse behind the Amoris Laetitia is to sort of fudge the moral teaching in order to find a way to accommodate the difficulties that people face in these situations. The problem is that fudging the morals creates a lot of confusion about what the morals actually are. And so these four cardinals are trying to clear up some of these questions to see whether Francis actually intends to break with the tradition of Catholic moral teaching and sacramental theology, or is just being vague and actually agrees with all of his predecessors on this topic. So the purpose of presenting the dubia or doubts is to force an answer from Francis on this topic. So it's an old tradition, actually. It goes back to the earliest days of the Church that you could submit questions to your local ordinary or to some sort of synod or ultimately to Rome to get final answers on a given theological confusion. And so basically the cardinals are trying to trigger this this critical or doctrinal mechanism that's built into the Roman Catholic Church. They say, well, Francis, Holy Father, we want a clarification on this matter. So if he speaks, he's bound by the obligations of his office to speak in a way that's consistent with the Church and its traditions. He's a servant of the gospel. He's a servant of the tradition. And so he would have to say, well, yes, I agree with all of these things that have been established as definitive by my predecessors, you know, going back to Jesus and the gospel. Interestingly, he has opted at this point not to respond, not to affirm that he's fudging the morals, not to deny it. He's just not saying anything.
So these dubia were presented to the Pope on September 19th, I believe, and he decided not to respond. And so the cardinal's response to his non-response has been what?
They published the letter that they had submitted to him. And, you know, it's a very moderately toned, well-written letter. It's short. It's not verbose. There's no hostility detectable in it. You know, you can contrast it a little bit with a set of theological censures that were published by a group of theologians, many of them excellent theologians, a couple months ago, that pointed out problem areas within Amoris Laetitia, things that seemed to directly contradict established church teaching. So that was a little bit more forward. The cardinal's letter is just asking questions in a sort of tried and true way that's been standard, at least within the Vatican Curia for the past couple centuries.
How important is this? I mean, we're talking four cardinals.
Well, it's, you know, it depends on what happens. It depends on where they take it next. So the closest similar case that comes to mind in recent history was a letter submitted by Cardinals Ottaviani and Bacchi around the time of the promulgation of the Roman Missal under Paul VI in 1969, 1970, right about there, objecting to certain defects that they saw in the Missal and asking that Paul VI just delay the promulgation of the new Missal until these things had been fixed. So, you know, they had a problem, well, the new Mass isn't sacrificial enough, it sort of obscures key theological points, et cetera, et cetera. That document, what's called the Ottaviani intervention, has become a monument among traditionalists who are committed to the old form of the Roman Rite. But juridically, it has no significance whatsoever. I mean, Ottaviani was, at that point, a retired former curial chief. You know, he had been head of the Holy Office, which became the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. So he was a prestigious figure. It was a significant thing, but it had no real weight. The same thing is true with these dubia. They have no juridical significance, but what they do is they communicate that serious, high-minded officials within the church, men who have devoted their lives to serving the gospel and are very clear-headed, find things confusing or problematic in this document, and they see a need for a clarification. And so that really confirms to a lot of the faithful that, yes, things really are not so great right now. It would be good if Francis tried to clarify and adhere more closely to the traditions of the church.
My understanding is that if Francis does not issue a clarification, these cardinals may issue a formal correction. What's that about?
Right. So Edward Penton of the National Catholic Register had an interview the other day with Cardinal Burke, in which this point comes up. Burke says that if the Holy Father fails to do this, that they would be willing to issue a formal correction. So that's, it's happened. It's a very unusual sort of thing to happen. But basically what that would look like is the cardinals protesting to the Pope and saying, hey, Francis, Holy Father, you really need to do this. Because by not doing it, you appear to consent to these errors, which you must not hold by virtue of your office. And in other words, it's kind of like in the Old Testament, if you think of the prophet Nathan going to David and saying, you know, hey, king, think about this moral scenario. Well, hey, you're that guy. You did these bad things. You need to change your ways, and sort of try and trigger up an act of repentance or some sort of change.
But not to trigger a schism.
No, people love throwing around the word schism lately. For the past few years, there's been all this buzz about schism. I don't think that there is any chance of a schism, certainly not from people like Burke or Brent Miller, who both were behind this letter, because these guys are so committed to Catholic doctrine and to the primacy of the Apostolic See. I think that they would see it as a grave sin on their part to separate themselves from that. So the last time there was an active schism in the church, or a well-publicized one, it was in 1988 when Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre illegally consecrated four bishops against the express wishes of Pope John Paul II. And that act of schism was also really uncharacteristic, but it's the sort of thing that had been worked up to very slowly over the course of about 20 years, where just 2 years ago, Burke was in one of the top positions in the Vatican Curia. It's unlikely. None of these guys are outsiders. None of them have been alienated or persecuted to the extent that would drive them to that kind of act. So I really don't think it's likely that there will be any sort of schism. If we did see a schism in the long run, I think it would be in response to reactionary measures, sort of restorationist measures by a later pope, and we would see maybe some of the Northern European bishops splitting off or just flagrantly violating canon law or papal decrees in order to continue playing out their sort of progressive, I guess, neo-modernist version of Catholicism that they've created for themselves.
Which is very well funded by...
by the Kirchensteuer, right, the German state church tax.
The figure of Cardinal Burke is very interesting. He's a sort of kind of flamboyant figure in a way,
yeah.
Certainly a hero figure for a certain type of Catholic.
Yeah.
But his career has had some ups and downs recently.
Yeah, yeah, it's had some downs recently. So Burke, let's see, Raymond Burke was the Archbishop of St. Louis for some time. And then he was promoted into the Apostolic Signatura, which is the supreme legal office in the Vatican Curia. He was there for a while under Benedict, and then toward the beginning of Francis's pontificate, and he's gradually been stripped away from all of the major offices that he held. So he was removed from his role as head of the Apostolic Signatura, and made instead the cardinal protector of the military order of the Knights of Malta, which is very cool, but it's not an authoritative position. I mean, before he sort of set the standard for the imposition of canon law throughout the world. Now he does important relief work with the Knights of Malta. He was removed from the Congregation for Bishops, which helps vet and select candidates for episcopal ordination all over the world. So yeah, he's really taken a fall under Francis.
And he's a target of great schadenfreude.
Oh, yeah.
Among liberals.
Oh yeah. Well,
they just love to point out to him that he's fallen.
He checks a lot of boxes that sort of trigger liberal Catholic hatred. There are all these photographs of Burke wearing his Kappa Magna, you mm-hmm. know, the giant flowing silk red liturgical garb.
He officiated the wedding of a friend of mine uh-huh. this summer, and she said, "My one issue is I want his train to be shorter than mine." And that was not a guarantee.
No. So... yeah, he has no problem being very outspoken and direct about Catholic doctrine. You know, we hear from a lot of the African bishops these very frank condemnations of Western decadence, and I think that because they're African, because they're foreign to the sort of American culture, we can deal with that and say, oh wow, you know, that's fresh and different. But when someone with a Wisconsin accent starts saying the same sorts of stuff that's like really aggressively in your face, you know, condemning of American culture or certain moral problems, people tend to get offended because, you know, Americans aren't supposed to think like that. I don't know. There's some sort of hubris or I don't know, maybe racist mindset behind that. So yeah, people really, really can't stand him.
God bless him though. He's so right.
Yeah, he's great. He's a real delight, and he's a treasure. You know, I had friends I remember from St. Louis when I was studying theology, who were really hoping that he was going to come out of the 2013 conclave as pope. Didn't happen.
Not quite.
Not quite.
Got the next best thing.
You know, God bless Pope Francis.
Long may he reign.
Yes.
The First Things podcast will be off for Thanksgiving and will return after the holiday. In the meantime, please enjoy this special message from Assistant Editor Alexi Sargent.
Greetings, First Things listeners. However you feel about national politics and church politics at this season, it's important to keep in mind that gratitude is always an option you have. There are so many things in this life and in this nation that we can be grateful for. So on behalf of the First Things editorial staff, I wanted to give you a little reminder of some of those things. Rusty reminds us that we can be thankful for mountains and espresso. Mark wants to make sure we remember to be thankful for hard-boiled detective fiction. Now Matthew wants to remind us to be thankful for hunting trips and Woodhouse novels. Julia reminds us that it's always worth being grateful for prestige dramas and the true crime genre. Elliot is thankful for fountain pens and children's catechisms. While Connor is thankful for classical music and some of the simple things like kicking back to read a nice volume of Heidegger. Viri is thankful always for poetry and also, most particularly, for Lord Peter Wimsey. And me, well, I'm thankful for heroes real and fictional. I'm thankful for the witness of the saints. And I think that you should all remember to be thankful for good food, to be thankful for your friends and your families, and for every person you encounter in your life who offers you an opportunity to love. So thank you, First Things listeners, and have a happy Thanksgiving.
That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to Mark Bauerlein for his insights into poetry and politics, and to Elliot Milko for his insights into popes and politics. Thanks also to Alexi Sargent for all the thanks he gives. The podcast will return after the holiday. Until then, happy Thanksgiving, and thank you, listeners.